Hey, Brad, you know what happens when it rains, but it's cold out?
For the sake of this cold open, no.
Well, I'm going to call this the coldest cold open.
A true physically cold open.
Is it the coldest cold open or is it just the coldest open? That's the question.
The coldest open.
Yeah.
You can't seed a topic or a title for this episode that early. I'm sorry.
Look, I'm sorry. I apologize for my error, but
now you're just playing to the crowd.
It's spring break week in the Smith household, and we piled everyone into the family truckster and drove up to Tahoe thinking, oh, we'll have a nice week. We'll see. It's springtime. We'll ride some bikes. We'll go on some hikes. Maybe we'll see some animals. It's going to be really pretty. It's going to be some outdoor nature time. If we want to see a little bit of snow, we can drive up to 8,000 feet and we'll be able to see some snow.
Joke's on you.
Little did we know that was like a foot and a half of snow ago. It stopped finally.
Okay.
We were planning on driving home. I was supposed to be in the car as we record this, driving home. But we're extending our stay for reasons.
Yeah. How did this go over with the proprietor of the establishment? I assume they're probably used to it.
Well, they were planning on coming up this weekend and they are equally hosed. So they were like, yeah, no, we'll happily take more money if you want to stay longer. Sure. That's good. Yeah. So,
well, it's not so much that you want to stay longer.
Yeah. Look, I usually buy chains I usually rent a 4x4. And I buy chains, or at least an all-wheel drive car, and I buy chains for the car, which is kind of expensive. I don't know if you noticed, rental cars have gotten crazy expensive during the pandemic.
Oh.
Like what would have been a $250 or $300 rental, say, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, was $700 when we looked.
Wow. Holy crap.
Yeah. So
that's so expensive, I'm moving away from the microphone.
Yeah. You lean back. You almost fell out of your chair. So yeah, anyway, we're up here. It snowed. The power was off and on all day yesterday. Came back like this morning for good, we think.
Fingers crossed we can make it through this podcast.
I'm on a battery, but the internet will conk out. So if the podcast ends abruptly, it's probably my fault. The snow on the roof of the house. You probably didn't hear that. But there's a foot and a half of snow on the roof of the house. And every once in a while, a big chunk of it will melt enough that it breaks off and slides.
Okay.
And when I heard it at 6 o'clock yesterday morning, I thought we were having an earthquake. Like it sounded like that rumble you get when you get an earthquake. Thud. And everybody in the house leapt out of bed. We like ran out. We're like, what was this? What the hell was that? And it was just, 200 pounds of snow rolling off the roof. So
yeah, I thought you were going to say the weight of the snow was making the roof like creak and you were starting to question its structural integrity. So I think snow falling off the roof is highly preferable.
It's been awesome. Like this is the second time my daughter has seen snow at a time that she would remember. Cause like, we live in Northern California. We don't get snow.
Yeah.
And we've had a good time. We went on like a short sleeves hike on Tuesday. Where we're like, I had a fleece and a pair of jeans on. We walked like 3.5-4 miles and saw some really pretty stuff. And then went to bed that night and it was still relatively clear. And the next morning we woke up and it was like a foot of snow on the ground. So yeah.
Now you can walk like 3.5-4 feet.
Yeah. And I did the bougie thing where I sat in the hot tub out back while it was snowing yesterday.
Was there a beer involved?
Look, maybe. I don't know. I'm going to tell you, it's an okay way to live, it seems like. So,
Well, here's the real question.
Yeah.
How are your stocks?
Which stocks?
How are your supplies?
Oh,
well, I mean, you can't leave, right? Like, just to clarify, I mean, you cannot drive to a store, right?
I could probably drive now. I would have to buy chains to go over the pass, over Donner Pass where it hits 8,000 feet because it's still pretty snowy up there.
Yeah. Did you drive your EV?
We drove the EV. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah. So we stopped at the grocery store on the way back from the hike. And I was like, I'm going to buy some hot dogs just in case. And Gina was like, that's so stupid. There's a market and like three restaurants down the hill from us. It's like a 5-minute walk. It'll be fine. But as soon as the power went off, everything shut down. Like they were like, no, we don't have a way to. I was like, can I buy some matches? They're like, we don't really know how to charge for them. I was like, can I just Venmo you $5 for like this box of matches? I will massively overpay for the matches. They were like, yeah, you can do that. So we got matches to light the stove, to light the gas range.
Wow, that's like one step away from like a barter system at that point.
It was close. I realized I put on one pair of jeans when we were leaving and I'd loaded them up with like some cash and all that stuff because I don't usually keep cash in my wallet. And then I changed pants right before we left, and I left the cash in the other pants. So we rolled all the way up here with like $3 cash nice. On us, I think. It's like, look, it worked out.
Hey, look, you got hot dogs, you got matches. I think you'll be fine.
The hot dogs were delish. Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad. I'm wondering how long to keep talking because of the latency. Like, we try to practice good mic discipline here, and like, you know, the cleaner we talk, the less editing involved. But when there's like a few extra, or maybe a few hundred extra milliseconds.
Yeah, it's I'm on a cable modem, and it's a bad. It's like a by Bay Area standards, it's probably like a mid 2000s, early 2010s cable. Like, it's like 30 megabits down and basically nothing up.
That's maybe functional.
Yeah, but it's fine. It's better than the satellite we had a few months ago. It's not as good as the fiber we had in the desert last year. So,
I mean, you can't beat that desert fiber.
I love that, man. Desert fiber. So it gets everything moving. But Brad, you have some interesting new hardware. Well, hold on. First, we're going to do two bits this week.
Split topic.
Yeah, because you have a play date, which I'm very curious about. I have paid for a pre-order, and I'm waiting for it to arrive.
Oh, you did.
I'm in the first wave whenever they ship.
They shipped. Hang on. I'm burying the lead here. I'm getting ahead of myself.
But. Okay. It may be waiting for me when I get home. Who knows? But then we also have this kind of... We want to talk about some technology spring cleaning, because I the weekend before we left, I sat down and was like, man, I haven't updated stuff in a long time. And then when I made the list of all the things I had to update, it was bad. So I kind of want to talk through that and find out what people's strategies are for maintaining increasingly complicated home lab setups and things like that.
I'm looking at your list of things to update right here, and I just want to close it.
It's a lot of things.
It's a lot of things.
Yeah. Some of them are like urgent. Some of them not so much. It turns out.
Yeah. It's not quite a potpourri. When there are only two types of flowers, it's not quite a potpourri.
But yeah. No. It's a spring mix.
What do you think this play date is like? Is it like a sunflower?
I would call that a sunshine. Sunflowers are a little darker than that, I think. That's okay.
This thing's bordering on an orange. It's not quite yellow.
It looks bright yellow on the camera. It could be your white balance though. Yeah. It's smaller than I expected.
It's very small. Like, I'd say palm size. We're talking about the Playdate, the Panic Playdate.
Yeah, the Panic Playdate designed by Teenage Engineering in collaboration with Panic, makers of fine Mac software for the last decades, and publishers of Firewatch and the Untitled Goose Game and something else, I think. I can't remember what the other one was.
The other one is about playing with your food. I forget what it is.
But I don't think it's out yet.
I don't think we'll spend a ton of time talking about games here. We covered this thing on Nextlander quite a bit this week.
Plug in your other podcast,
That's, you know, let's say there are probably some listeners of both.
I'd say there's overlap. Yeah.
That stuff. But like, I think you also have messed with the SDK for this thing a little bit.
I downloaded it and I tried to write a Hello World program in about 45 minutes and I didn't quite get there.
Oh, you didn't? Okay. I didn't either.
The power went out midway through that. So I was like, am I going to use my laptop battery to do this? No, I'm going to stop here. And I couldn't look up stuff anymore. And it got complicated.
Yeah.
Also, I've never really used Lua outside of like ancient WoW UI mod hacking stuff.
That was definitely the most prominent example I knew of Lua usage before this thing.
Oh, Lua is really, really popular in the game design world. A lot of scripting that doesn't need to be performant. A lot of people use Lua for that.
Can I ask? I mean, I don't know if you've been in game development long enough, and we're super getting ahead of ourselves on the playdate. But I was reading up on Lua after I had messed with the SDK a little bit, and like, it's got a pretty kind of, I guess I'd say, full featured C API. Like, it hooks into C quite well. Like, you can kind of run Lua inside of lower level compiled languages. Like, what is the, because like you said, when you don't need as much speed, it's something you can fall back on. But like, what is the upside in a development context? Like, it's just easier to use. Is that essentially the main reason? It's harder to write C well than it is to write a garbage collected language like Lua.
That's exactly it. Usually you have way more people on, like, for example, a lot of every studio is different, but like some of our level designers are competent, are like also good programmers in specific, like work in Blueprints and Unreal and stuff like that, and maybe wouldn't feel comfortable working in C. Is the difference. Okay. Also, you can cause real problems for yourself working in C, and using the more interpreted languages generally protect you from messing up too bad. Now, anybody who's used Unreal Blueprints is screaming at their radio right now, so I apologize. but yeah, I don't really work on that side of the business at all.
Yeah.
I know just enough to be dangerous. So
yes. All right. Well, why don't we talk about the unit itself and the hardware and any questions you have, and then we'll talk about our budding careers as game developers.
Yeah, the first thing I'm curious about, like the screen, the choice on the screen. Okay, well, okay, there's a bunch. It's a weird piece of hardware, right? It's like, it's a little tiny thing. It's got a screen. Yeah. It's got like Game Boy controls with a D-pad and two face buttons, right?
Yeah.
Triggers?
No triggers. No, that's okay. It. So it is D-pad, two face buttons, a home button.
And then the crank.
Lock button, and then the crank. Like, the crank is basically the only thing that differentiates this thing from an original Game Boy.
Yeah, it it has that real teenage engineering vibe of, like, hard edges and like, it's really clean looking, is what I would say, probably.
So speaking of the hard edges, my most recently discovered favorite use case for this thing?
Yeah.
Like the edges are.
Does it sit up
enough?
Like an iPhone 4?
Yes, it will stand up on it. So also, so we're talking about the screen.
Yeah.
Which they describe as one bit. I mean, I gather one bit just means pixels are on or off, right? Yeah. No shades of gray. I don't know what type of screen this is. I was trying to find it. I want to say it's made by Samsung. There's a specific name for this type of screen.
It's like a transflective thing though, right? Like it has a reflective thing in the back. It's kind of like the old GBA screen, but only one color. The original GBA screen.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, we'll get to the lack of backlight.
Okay.
But the point is, when you lock it, the screen does not go off. It says right in the instructions, like, hey, when you lock it, it'll go to a clock because the screen takes almost no power. So we were like, why not just leave it on?
There you go.
So because the clock never goes away and it stands up nicely on its bottom and it looks super cool, I'm now using it as a desk clock.
That's awesome.
It actually looks like awesome. At the back of my desk, just standing up next to my phone charger as a little clock.
So you said, is the lock a toggle or is it like a push button?
It's like a push
and hold unlock.
So like everything about this thing is just goofy and quirky. So like when you press the lock button, a little face pops up and you have to hit it twice to make it open both of its eyes and then it comes on.
I like that. Very cute.
But yeah, so like this thing is weird watching the internet react to this thing as all the reviews have been coming out.
I assume they're all over the place, right?
I haven't looked at a ton of the reviews. They're mostly fairly positive. I mean, some of them are like, you know, it's $180 for a thing that is like, I use the word toy on the Nextlander podcast, and I hate to keep saying that because like that sounds more dismissive than I mean for it to. It's a very niche enthusiast. Actually, I think hobbyist is the word that I would use. Like it's kind of a hobbyist thing.
I mean, the teenage engineering hardware is traditionally really kind of hacker friendly. Like the thing that I first heard about them making was a bunch of different synths that like used each one was a specific subset and you could wire them all together and make like dope chip tunes with.
Yeah.
But it was very like DIY and like they sold literal raw boards that like and posted plans so you could like laser cut or 3D print a case for them or whatever if you wanted.
Yeah, what is that the big synth they make, the OP1, I want to say?
That's the fancy industrial design one. The early ones were all just like it looked like the motherboard from a Game Boy with some buttons on it. Like no case, no battery, nothing. Like you plugged it into a USB power supply and then you could daisy chain a bunch of them together and build actual music with like three or four or five of them if you wanted, I guess.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, like, you know, this thing ships with 24 games, not all at once. I mean, they roll out over time. If you haven't heard, they do this like season model where you get two new games a week for 12 weeks.
I'm kind of into that because the games are kind of bite sized, right?
Yeah, a lot of them. I mean, some of them are action oriented, like arcadey enough that you get it in like 30 seconds. Like some of them are very much like, OK, I have played this for 1 minute and I get exactly what this game is. And then some of them are pretty like deeply story based, like they've got a lot of writing to them and a lot more depth.
What's the fishing game, Sitch?
Oh, I don't think there is one.
Wow, there's a real
real
void in the market there.
There's a surfboarding game.
Okay,
that works with the crank.
What does the crank do on the surfboarding game?
You steer the surfboard left and right by cranking one direction or the other. So it's kind of cool. I mean, it's like a nice,
it's like an nice analog
control.
It's like a one axis analog control.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting.
scrolling through here. It's a good mix of like arcade games and puzzle games and some story based, more some like overhead Zelda type stuff. Like the games are, there's a nice range.
So there are like more story driven, because most of the things I'd seen were pretty arcadey. Like the Keita Takahashi game looked pretty arcadey and like very crank focused.
Yes. Let me see here. I believe so. Echoic Memory, which I believe Samantha Coleman worked on, that's got a decent amount of story to it. So I'm still scrolling through here trying to remember. Saturday Edition. Let's see. Ratcheteer. Yeah. Ratcheteer is another one. So there's some that have some pretty dense narrative elements. There's even an XCOM clone of sorts. It's not really XCOM. It's more Advanced Wars, I would say, like turn-based strategy.
But a strategy game. That's cool. Yes. So the screen, you said it doesn't have a backlight. So I assume that means you need to have some sort of light on behind you in order to really see it, right?
Yes. There absolutely have been cases where I had to rotate 90 degrees in my chair because I just couldn't see it sitting up.
And is that in like a well-lit room or is that a dark room?
I don't get direct natural light in here right now, but there's like kind of good bounce lighting from the sun coming in. It's kind of hard to see right now.
Okay. So like you would rotate 90 degrees off camera. Yes. Okay.
So I'm like holding it pointed at this window now and I can see it fine.
Huh.
But as soon as I rotate back kind of perpendicular to the way the window is facing, it's kind of tough to see.
That's interesting.
So yeah,
does it seem like something you just kind of leave in your bag all the time? Like in a world where we still commuted and things like that.
Right. From which standpoint, in terms of durability, like it bouncing around in the bag or the battery life, or what are you, all of the above?
I was thinking about more ease of like the way you would want to access it. Like, is this something you'd whip out on the bus to play a game, or are you more likely to pull out your phone?
It depends on what kind of game. Like if the bus bounces around a lot, I've tried to play enough like Switch and Vita games over the years. Like anything that involved the crank, I would say, is probably not great on public transit.
Okay.
Like on an airplane, it would be fine, assuming you're not experiencing turbulence.
Yeah, I used to play 3DS games on the BART fairly regularly, but it's a smoother ride than the bus usually.
Yeah. And the D-pad and button controls should probably be fine on a bus, but anything where you're getting jostled, the crank would be tough to finesse.
Interesting. Have they talked about the market, like what the market for future, like they've released a ton. We'll talk about the SDK and stuff later, but they've released a ton of tools just for anybody to build stuff for it, for the play date. I assume that they have a plan for either future seasons or like a a la carte store. Have they talked about any of that stuff at all?
So an official season 2 from them seems to be up in the air right now. They have a FAQ up and some of the stuff has changed over time, as you know, this thing slipped like 18 months or something.
Yeah. Well, the pandemic original was unkind for hardware people.
Yeah. It's understandable. But I think a lot of these details have evolved as the delays have come into effect.
Okay.
As of right now, they literally in the FAQ have a question about a season 2 and they're like, we're figuring it out. We're not 100% sure yet. Like, I would assume if they do sponsor a season 2, they would charge for it, but I don't know. There is no storefront on this thing or on their website or anywhere. The only thing, and this is one of the things that I think is the coolest thing about this thing, it's very easy to sideload games onto it.
Okay.
And literally they panic themselves are pointing people at a bunch of itch pages right now, just like, hey, so-and-so is making a game for this thing. Here's their itch page. Like, you can just buy it from the itch page and download the zip file and just sideload it onto your thing.
And you just copy a zip file, like you plug it in, it's a USB drive and you copy it over?
Yeah, there are two ways, actually. You can do it through the website. You have an account on play.date, and you go there, and there's a little sideload tab on the page, and you drag the... They're actually .pdx files, which I thought was very cutesy.
That's very cute, yeah.
Them being based in Portland and everything.
Portland.
But you literally drag the PDX file onto the sideload page on your account page, and that actually sends it to the cloud, and then you download it over Wi-Fi onto the play.date.
You can
sideload over USB as well, but you have to use the SDK for that.
So it works like that. So that cloud thing works like the old Kindle sideloading thing that you could do. I mean, you can still do it, but that's really cool. Like that,
the technical implementation of the sideloading is cool to me, but it's more the kind of commerce aspect of it. It's more that like they aren't running their own storefront. They're not trying to peel 30% of revenue off of whatever games get made for this thing, right? They're just saying like Lucas Pope, for example, is making a Playdate game right now, like the Papers, Please and Return of the Obra Dinn developer. And he's got it on itch. And it's like, when he's done with it, you'll just go, pay him through itch for the game and download it. And Panic's like, yeah, whatever.
I mean, there's something really cool about Panic saying, hey, we're putting this thing out here. It's, they didn't call it, I don't think Cable ever called it an experiment, but like, it's kind of implied that it's, they wanted to do something that was more hardware-y after publishing a couple of games. And like, their first rev store is not going to be anything anywhere near as good as something like Itch is. So right. why not draft on Itch and let the rising tide lift all ships, right?
Totally.
That's really cool.
And that's part of what I was going to mention earlier about the response to this thing as the reviews have come out, is that there's this whole kind of console warrior response to this thing of people like sneering down their noses at it. It's like, oh, that fucking thing is never going to make it. Like, it can't compete against this. You know what I mean? It's like, people are treating this thing like it's a new video game console that's trying to compete with other video game consoles, when it's extremely not that. Well, like, that's what I meant about calling it a hobbyist device. Like, I think it is as much for people who want to tinker with a cool device and like potentially try to code something for it, or go out and find some of the non-game things people are developing for it and try those out, you know, than it is like something for like serious hardcore gamers.
I mean, there's, well, okay, I kind of am offended by the idea that serious hardcore gamers can't be interested in something that they want to noodle with, but we can get back later.
No, what I'm saying is there are a bunch of people out there who are only approaching it from that angle. And kind of sneering at its existence in a way that is really weird.
Yeah, that's weird, because it's not like this isn't like the Ouya or the Stadia or something where they came out and were like, hey, we're going to change console gaming forever. Right. We're going to make this completely new thing. They've been really transparent from the beginning with this, where they're like, hey, we wanted to make a cool, like, this is a thing that we thought was cool and would like to have, because we feel like there's no space for this kind of game in the world anymore. And like, I remember I talked to Samantha at some point, and I remember being kind of pleasantly surprised by what her take on the dev cycle for this thing was, compared to, say, you know, I don't want to say Vita, but like a Switch is, at this point, there's no difference between building a Switch game and building a game for any other console at this point. And that's the closest thing we have to a handheld right now. Right. So like, the idea that like in the GBA time, in the Xbox 360 GBA time frame, there was an interesting kind of lo-fi game scene going on the GBA, where people were making what were essentially like modern SNES games that just happened to be handheld. And we saw, like, you know, Capcom made the Minish Cap, which is, I think, one of the better Zelda games in that time frame. And having that having limited resources and limited hardware lets you do different things and sets different expectations for like production value and stuff like that. So like I guess what I'm trying to say in the longest, most roundabout way is, having a mobile handheld indie game platform seems like a win-win for anybody who likes indie games. Like, Activision's not going to put Call of Duty on this thing, but we're probably good.
Yes, probably. Yeah. Somebody did port Doom to it though.
Of course.
To be fair.
I mean, it always runs Doom. Everything runs Doom.
Here's the best example I would give is, so I downloaded the SDK yesterday, and in the space of an hour after installing the SDK, they include a bunch of projects that you can compile and run yourself. In the space of an hour after downloading the SDK, I had gone through, I had like looked through the code in some of those projects, and then figure out you'd have to compile them from the command line. There is a proper compiler for it. And you have to set an environment variable with the path to the compiler and stuff. Like, it's not dead simple if you've never done stuff in the command line, but like, in the space of an hour, I looked through the code in some of those projects. I figured out how to get them compiled and sideloaded onto the thing. And like, there I am playing homebrew games that I can look at the code for myself on the device in an hour. You know, like, that's awesome. Also, one of the examples they include is called Level 1-1. I think you can guess exactly what that is. But like, it's cool. I mean, like, Lua code is very readable. I never messed with it before, but it looks like a lot of the other kind of garbage collected languages where it's like pretty legible.
Yeah, if you understand basic syntax, then it's like, it is not overtly complicated in the way that like C or Perl or something like that, or even Python is.
And I was able to go through there and look at like kind of the algorithms that control like the movement of this fake Mario character in Level 1-1, and like kind of get a sense of like, oh, here's how they're calculating friction and like and stuff like that, you know, gravity and things like that. Like, it's awesome from that perspective. If you're interested in tinkering with things and seeing how things work, like, it's such a cool gateway into that world. Like, the tools are just pretty surprisingly accessible, I think.
I had intended to spend, and well, then they also have this web-based thing that is like one order of magnitude less complicated, it seems like. I just started poking at that when the internet conked out once and for all yesterday. But it seemed like there was an opportunity to do some like almost like blueprint code in Unreal or something like that, where you set up these set up a module that can do a thing, that can handle a thing, whether it's motion of the character or jumping or something like that. And then you can visually hook it up to the other modules and write little scripts that are then connected in a kind of flowcharty way that seems pretty manageable.
And I think even those games will save out to a .pdx that you can just distribute pass to your friends. Like, think about that. Like, that's kind of awesome. You know, it's kind of like a mixtape thing almost, of just like, hey, here, just give this game to your friends. Don't even bother trying to sell it. Just like, hey, here's a thing I made. Check it out.
I love it. So they unlocked all the games early for press units, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Do you feel like out of that first season, you got as much value as you want out of your, like, if you had, you paid the $200 or whatever it is?
If the development tools were not so readily accessible.
Yeah.
That would be a harder question to answer. I think probably.
Okay.
But because, like, I've already sideloaded half a dozen free games that people put out for this thing out there. So because of that aspect of it, I'd say it's absolutely worth it. If you're interested in tinkering with stuff like this, like,
I think like that idea of, hey, here's a place that developers whether professional who want to do side stuff and just noodle, or shade tree folks who want to learn, have a way to like, one of the problems with the early VR stuff was that, you know, in order to do a VR demo and show somebody what you've been working on, you had to schlep around a PC and a headset and some lighthouses and all this other stuff. And it was really hard to do demos and share work. This is the antithesis of that, right? Like,
right.
This, you just whip the thing out of your pocket, put it in, and then there you go. You're up and running. It sounds really cool.
It's neat.
I'm really excited to spend some time with it.
Yeah. But if you want a handheld video game device and you don't have any intention of like trying to write code for this thing, or even going out and finding games for it, like, again, like from the hardcore gamer angle, like, probably a harder sell.
Is there like an itch.io Playdate hub for set up for them?
No, yet? I found all those free games I mentioned Panic had a Twitter thread going of like, hey, why don't we just tweet some games that we know that people are working on?
So discovery, like, will be a challenge then.
Like, yeah, there is no centralized discoverability. Like, that's kind of refreshing to me. Like, we did the stream the other day, and I put this thing called Playnote Studio on there, which is a crank-based player for Flipnote Studio, which was a DSi, a Nintendo DSi thing.
Wow.
I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I remember those.
Yeah, Flipnote Studio was like literally a DSi-based flipbook animator, right? And so, you know, Nintendo kills everything off, so that's not around anymore. But you can somehow, I don't know what the process is, but you can dump those files from the old DSi game.
Okay.
And load them into this thing. So wow. It's like preserving a bunch of old animated work that people did years ago. But the reason I brought this up, that the thing I thought was cool, was I only knew about that because I randomly stumbled across somebody on my feed retweeting it. Like, there's no store to dig through.
They need a blog or something, at minimum.
I mean, it's early days. But like, some people are going to roll their eyes at this. It felt cooler because I just randomly discovered it in a way that I very easily could have just missed.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, this is a thing people are talking about, and oh, wow, I can just download this file on this random website, load it onto my device, and there it is.
Have you joined any Playdate Discords yet, Brad?
No, not quite.
Okay.
Not quite.
I mean, it seems like having a Discord channel for this might be interesting if people get enough of them.
Definitely.
The other thing is, the emulator is available as part of the SDK, and I don't think you can load the season one stuff. I assume you could load anything you download from itch.io into that.
Yes.
And see what it looks like.
Yes.
Although,
yes,
the warning on that is really funny, because it says, yo, this is going to run a lot faster on your computer than it will run on the Playdate. So make sure you run whatever you build on the hardware to make sure it actually works. Like, did they talk about what kind of CPU and stuff is in this?
I've got the specs here. Let me pull them up real fast. They actually changed out the CPU late in production due to supply chain issues.
Yeah, because they had some supply. They were really transparent about how this was going all the way through. I've been reading the blogs as they post them.
Oh, this spec sheet in the SDK does not have the details on the CPU. I really want to know that.
I thought it was a MIPS thing, but I can't remember for sure.
Is it MIPS, not ARM?
Might be ARM. I was surprised when I saw.
Let's just see here. It is ARM based. It is an ST Microelectronics STM32F746.
Oh yes, it's 7426. That's yeah. Okay.
I think that's the one that's in it now. I don't, unless that's the one they started with and then retired in favor of the slower one. I'm actually not sure. It is ARM-based, though.
Okay.
Let me see some other stuff about the specs here real fast.
Can you put your own like OS? Like, do they let you jailbreak it to the point that you can put your own OS on it, presumably?
Not so far.
Okay.
I doubt that is a thing.
That will come with time if it's going to happen.
Somebody very, very well could find a way to root and port other OSs to it. Let's see. So it's 400 by 240.
Okay.
The screen refreshes at 30 hertz by default. Goes up to a maximum of 50.
Okay.
That's reasonable. 16 megabytes of RAM.
What is the 16 megs of RAM, huh? Wow, that's shockingly little.
Yeah, it really is. When you think about it, my Pentium 75 in 1996 had 16 megabytes of RAM.
How much storage and how much, like, I assume there's like cache built into the SoC, but like how much storage does it doesn't need 3D or anything like that, right? So it's just,
I don't think so.
How does it sound? Teenage Engineering is usually really good at sound.
Sounds great. It's got full digital audio capabilities. So
I assume. Actually, oh, go ahead.
That was an interesting thing reading through the SDK guidelines. Like, they've got some do's and don'ts and stuff. And that was one of the things. First of all, they start off saying like we'd love it if you kept the size of games down because the storage on this thing is not infinite and it will run out. And like, we think kind of 40 to 60 megabytes is maybe the ideal of the top end for game size, and also audio is the thing that will eat all of your space.
40 to 60 megabytes. Wow.
So please try to keep your audio assets compressed and as minimal as possible. There is a game in the shipping season one that is less than a megabyte. It's like 875 kilobytes.
I was going to say, I would assume most of what you would use for something like this would be MIDI stuff that then you just load a sound bank for or whatever.
I think that's or synthesis or yeah. I mean, like wave or FM synth.
Yeah. There
is at least one game in here that seems to use actual digital music.
Wow. What a trip. My assumption also is that people will, if the sound processing stuff is pretty good, that we'll see a lot of like Electroplankton type, like gamey synth things that you can use to make some cool music with. Because with the analog, with the crank, you can control tempo and things like
that. Absolutely.
There's a bunch of interesting things you could do with this from a music standpoint, I would think.
There is a thing, it's at the very, hang on, let me crank my way to the top of the list because that's way faster than the D-pad. What is it called? Boogie Loops. Boogie Loops is a music creator.
Okay.
For this thing. So it ships with one, which is awesome.
You're going to need like 30 play dates all hooked up into your mixer.
Somebody will probably make that happen.
I'm going to tell you, if you go look up the Teenage Engineering synth setups on YouTube, you'll see some amazing stuff that people have set up, like pads all around them with the, anyway, doesn't matter.
Yeah. Anyway, this thing is neat. It is very much for like the hobbyist enthusiast. Like, it's not just a traditional games player. The games are fine. Like, the games are cool, but you can probably tell I am way more excited about the development tools and the weird projects people are going to find to gen up for it. And like, I'm pretty inspired to like keep looking through the code for these sample projects and like seeing if I can write something where I can move a sprite around the screen and stuff, like,
I was going to say, is this for old people, Brad?
Maybe.
Okay. When I get mine in, I will find, I'll put it in front of a 9-year-old and let you know what they think. It's springtime, Brad.
Oh, spring has sprung, huh?
Well, some places.
It's like,
I'm gonna go put my snow boots on in a minute.
I think it's like 75 degrees here right now.
Every once in a while, like, somebody, my doorbell camera would pop up over the last couple of days and be like, and I'd look at the picture on it and be like, man, it's really sunny up there. I'm paying money to be here in the cold. What the hell's wrong with me?
But it's really pretty cold based on the photos you've been taking.
Exceptionally, like, it is gorgeous. I've never seen. Like, I grew up in mountains in Tennessee and we saw snow, but nothing like this. It's been bonkers. Like, last night at one point there were snowflakes about the size of a dime, just drifting, wafting down. But you know what I usually do in the springtime is clean things.
Oh,
well, the house, yes. The windows get cleaned in the spring, whether they need it or not. They always need it.
Hang on. It just made me realize we've never cleaned the windows in this apartment.
You rent the apartment. You shouldn't have to clean the windows. Just let them grime up. You're getting just live privacy live with dirty that way. Windows. Yeah, exactly. If you can still see out them, they're clean enough. But we are going to, I went through last weekend and did a bunch of computer maintenance. I updated my NAS server, which I hadn't done in a embarrassingly long time.
You're still on TrueNAS?
I'm on TrueNAS still.
What,
yeah.
What version were you on?
I was on, it was still called FreeNAS when I was,
that's not too before. Bad.
It's only 11.3, I think. Probably
11.3 was the last major version before the current major version.
Yeah. Like,
so that's not too bad,
but I hadn't updated. So I have my theory on internal security stuff, and people are going to yell at me for this, I'm sure, is that if it connects to the outside world, it has to be updated regularly. And if it only lives inside the net, inside the NAT, then, you know, whenever it's convenient.
That's kind of where I'm at for the most part.
Yeah. So I hadn't updated. I was on 11.3 U1, the initial release version of FreeNAS 11.3.
Okay. That's less good.
Yeah, it wasn't great. So I updated that, and then that meant that I had to go through and update all the jails. And when I updated all the jails, I had to update all the apps running inside the jails. And like, well, I usually keep the Plex server relatively up to date just in the hopes that one day we'll get hardware and code on BSD, which I think is never going to happen.
So you can, but not on TrueNAS.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of digging, sadly.
Reason number 431 to switch to Linux for Plex.
We'll get into this. I've also been doing some stuff.
I updated the Pi hole. Like I keep the gravity lists up to date. Runs automatically, but updating the Pi hole, you have to I have to shell into the Raspbian and install and like, you know, it was in equilibrium. It was working. I didn't want to futz with it too much. So did that. I did the Home Assistant updates, which I do regularly, but there's also stuff like they've been moving the Home Assistant things out of the configuration.yaml and into like a more GUI oriented setup now. So a lot of times if you have the old crufty installation with the configuration.yaml, you either have to clear it out of the config YAML file, or you have to remove it, back it up, remove it, reinstall it, and then re-dump in the settings for your integration.
Yeah.
I moved my Z-Wave from the legacy deprecated Z-Wave install to the new, not deprecated, but still equally janky Z-Wave install.
This is in Home Assistant?
This is in Home Assistant.
I get the sense that there's maybe a bit of strife around the direction of Home Assistant. Like, I think it may very well be from people who are not happy they're moving away from simple text-based configuration.
There's... The Home Assistant stuff is better than what I was using closed source stuff for still.
Yeah.
But it is still janky in a similar but different way.
Yes, that's for sure. So I also just updated randomly 2 nights ago, updated my Home Assistant because I was on the version from last June.
Yeah.
They do monthly major versions.
Multiple monthlies often. Well,
yeah, I think they'll do like a feature release at the beginning of the month and then patches throughout. So I was on last June's. First of all, I could only update to last December's because they have now changed Python versions.
And
I would have to go create a new virtual environment, I'd have to install a newer version of Python in the container and then make a new.
Wait, are you running in a jail or are you running
it? I'm running it on a Pi in an LXC container. Okay. So I would have to install Python 3.9 in that container and then make a new virtual environment with the newer Python and move the config over. It's a pain.
I have a whole Pi dedicated to it because I have a bunch of stuff running. It's actually kind of heavy. And as a result, it has the OS is managed. Like I get OS updates through the UI, which includes
did you install from the image they put out?
Yeah.
Like Home Assistant OS or whatever they call it.
Way easier and way less maintenance. Yes. Because each month I get multiple and the core OS updates are less frequent, it seems like, than the Home Assistant updates. So I'll get a core OS update. You would do that first and then you do the console update and then whatever add-ons or whatever get updated after that.
Got it. Yeah, I do a bunch of other stuff on that Pi, so I have to keep everything kind of compartmentalized. Yeah. But the thing I was going to say about jank, though, is that I updated to that more recent version, instantly populated my Apple Home with like kind of virtual bridges for like every device in this house out of nowhere that do nothing. Like they don't actually activate anything when you flip them on, but there's just like double the number of icons in Apple Home now.
Oh, really?
It's for whatever reason, that newer version is exposing those bridges in a way that it wasn't before.
Oh, they should... That's not working right. So for me, that just pops up. It just mirrors my Home Assistant configuration in Apple Home, which means I can use Siri to configure it to change lights and stuff, which is actually super convenient.
Yeah, like it's entirely possible there's a way for me to go in there and like clear all that out, that it's like config cruft or something. But who has the time?
It might be you might be in a situation where you are on the bad version of that particular plugin, because last December, or maybe when that was having problems, I can't remember.
Huh. Okay.
The thing about Home Assistant is you always have to read the release notes when you update, because sometimes they will just break something that's really crucial to you.
I discovered that in the course of this, because I hadn't updated in a while. Like, they have now added to their release notes every month a section called breaking changes.
Yeah.
And they were very explicitly in the update process like, make sure you look at the breaking changes before you upgrade to make sure it's not going to break anything you want. And I'm like, what is going on here when you were breaking that much functionality every month?
Well, it's usually stuff that's like lightly used, because they get data about what plugins and what integrations are being used.
Yeah.
So it's usually like Hue 1.0 was deprecated a few months ago in a way that was specific and also revocable if you wanted to turn it back on and stuff like that. Like I feel like they're doing I kind of wish they would do fewer major updates, because I know that it feels like it's probably just because my setup is pretty stable now and I don't actually need the changes, and the changes almost always cause me hassle. I guess I don't have to upgrade them, but I also feel like if I fall behind on that one in particular, I'll be in the situation where you are, where I change it and I have to read like 4,000 patch notes updates and I'm still wondering if things are going to break anyway.
And for something that runs all the lights in your house, and probably a lot more in your case, like that's critical infrastructure.
The lights all work without Home Assistant, but it is nice when I like fire up a Twitch stream or have a meeting when the lights go to the right setting for that. Anyway.
Yeah.
The biggest problem I have is that every time I update lately, it's been kicking off all my Zigbee bulbs, which is a huge pain in the butt, because you have to the way you sync those is by doing the on for 1 second, off for 2 seconds, on for 1 second, off for 2 seconds on every single bulb. I'm going to replace the bulbs. I think the problem is the bulbs. The thing I've learned is that on the Zigbee stuff, the firmware is supposed to be updated by the controller. And since they're open, and the Cree, the bulb manufacturer that I used for those bulbs, doesn't supply firmware, they can't update your firmware on your bulbs. So if there's some sort of incompatibility or something, the solution is to pair them to a closed proprietary source that will update all the bulbs. Never. And then repair them with your Home Assistant thing.
Never.
Which would be fine, except for there's like 15 of those bulbs in my house. Anyway. This is a first world problem. The upgrading the jails was surprisingly complex, because like, I don't know about you, but I often, when I load a jail in TrueNAS, I'll get that, hey, this is running a different version of the kernel when you do the package update thing.
Yes. Oh, wait. Yes, I know. So I wanted to talk about that. That's exactly why I am thinking about getting off of TrueNAS.
Yeah.
Is it where you try to update your packages and it's like, hey, these packages are for a newer version than you're running?
Yeah.
So the reason that happens is TrueNAS locks in on a given version of FreeBSD.
Uh-huh.
Currently, it's 12.2. The problem is the FreeBSD group, organization, whatever you want to call it, end of life's old versions, like incredibly fast.
Yeah.
The end of support for a given major version of FreeBSD is the release of the next version plus 3 months. So they only support the last version for 3 months past the release of the next version, which is like pretty short. And granted, like, it's not a huge development community. Like, I often wonder how healthy the FreeBSD scene is these days. They don't have a ton of resources to support old versions, but TrueNAS locks in, like I said, on a version and takes forever to move on to a new version. So there's going to be like 3 months out of every year where you can't really safely update the packages on that thing, because the FreeBSD people are no longer maintaining the repo for that version that you're still stuck running for a while.
Well, so I'll tell you, it usually works.
It's usually fine. Like, unless there's been like some major ABI changes or whatever, the newer packages than the kernel you're running usually will be okay, but there's never a guarantee.
Yeah. And also I had some jails that were running an ancient version of the kernel Because when you update the TrueNAS version from 11.0, when I updated from 11.3 to whatever TrueNAS 12.1 or whatever it is now.
12.2. It's TrueNAS 12.0, but it's running on FreeBSD 12.2.
Yeah, I had to update the jails individually to use the new kernels, which was terrifying because anyway, I'm not a huge fan of that.
Yeah, so what's actually happening there, if you really care about the minutia, you're actually updating like the user land. Like the kernel you're running on is the kernel of the base system, but all of the packages that are in that jail are for a different version. So that's what they're trying to get you to update. But it's such a pain.
It is a huge pain, and it's ambiguously dangerous in a way that makes me uncomfortable.
Yes.
And makes me think that like maybe the Docker people are right or the container people are right that, hey, just having your own little chunk of the OS in here is maybe the safer way to do this.
I actually have been thinking about Docker and Podman and a lot of that stuff lately, as I've also been like, we're both in that window right now, but like,
It's like, is it Proxmox? Is it Docker? What am I going to do? I don't know, but I'm going to do something, I think.
So that's what I rolled in here wanting to talk about. I think I'm finally done. I think I'm finally officially fed up with being stuck. Let me step back. I want to be fair to the TrueNAS people. I think we are both using that thing in a way that is like kind of not super intended. Like it's kind of, we're edge cases for what they would say TrueNAS should be used for.
The business of TrueNAS is workgroup servers, and we are definitely not using it for workgroup servers in the sense that they would expect you to.
And they offer, vetted and community plugins.
Yeah.
That they say like, hey, you should use the plugins we offer, not like go make your own jails and set up your own stuff. But of course, we didn't listen to that anyway.
Well, but at the time when I went and made my own jails for all this stuff, it was because the community plugins were lagging six months to a year behind.
Yes.
On services that actually needed the updates. So.
Yes. So anyway, I am fed up with being boxed in. And again, it's not their fault. It's just that the thing they make is not really appropriate for my use case. So here's the revelation that I had last weekend.
Yeah.
You can boot off of USB drives now.
Yeah.
I've got old SSDs stacked up.
Yeah.
I've got a SATA to USB cable.
Uh-huh.
I was like, why don't I just like screw around with like a SSD that I can chuck in the trash? And by chuck in the trash, I mean format. And so I hooked up one of the SSDs and just installed straight up FreeBSD 13.0 to it.
Oh boy, you just went, but that's not the way I would have gone, but okay.
And then I hooked up the other SSD and installed Debian Stable to it.
Oh, okay. Okay. Now I'm back on board.
And so I'm just going to plink around with both of them and decide which direction I want to go. Like,
are you hooking them up to your ZFS pool?
Yeah. Like I installed it to the TrueNAS machine, just to a different drive that I can boot off of at will.
Let's go one step deeper here. What if you put a hypervisor?
I know the argument. Here's the thing, though. Here's the thing about Proxmox, though. Like, I absolutely get the use case of Proxmox, but I kind of don't want to run an appliance platform anymore. Like, Proxmox still is bound to a UI, and you're still pulling updates on their schedule, right? Like, you're still, to some degree, going to be limited by the choices that the Proxmox group makes. Proxmox is just Debian and KVM with web UI on it. I mean, I'm being reductive. What if I just ran that stuff for real? What if I could just update anything whenever I want and not worry about anybody saying this is a bad idea?
I mean, the point of the Proxmox, though, is that you do run that stuff for real. You just run it one layer deeper.
Oh, I know. Right? I know. But what I mean is, like, and I talked to some people on the Discord. I'm quoting Wycross. Is that how you say his name?
That's how I always say Wycross. Yeah.
Like he mentioned, like he put it in kind of a way that I'm not at his level, but I'm like kind of aspirationally moving in that direction, where he was like, because he just runs an NAS with Linux on it. And he was like, hey, I'm very comfortable in Linux. Like, I know how to provision VMs with KVM myself. You know, I can do all this myself. That's what I'm going to do. And so, like, that's kind of the direction I'm going in. It's just going to take some time.
That was my thought is replace the big heavy machine with a 6-core Nuke.
Yeah.
And
if you just want to run storage on the box and not do all the other stuff, like something like a Proxmox or a TrueNAS makes more sense.
Yeah.
But like, I'm sitting here doing like inventory now of everything that TrueNAS does for you and thinking about, oh, I'm going to have to like replicate that functionality myself if I go through with this. And it's like, but it's like, I think the way I would put it is like, I'm figuring out all the stuff I'm going to have to do myself.
Yeah.
But I'm also figuring out all the stuff I'm going to get to do myself. Because as an example, like the scheduling in TrueNAS is terrible. Like, it's not good. Like
scheduling like crontab type stuff?
So that's the thing. Like, the scrub scheduling uses cron.
Yeah.
But the smart scheduling uses smart's built-in scheduling. But the interfaces look identical, so you don't realize that they actually don't work the same way. And also, like, the cron stuff is extremely limited in a way that you could absolutely do more with if you're just writing scripts yourself. So it's stuff like that, you know, where it's like, oh, like, there's scheduling I would like to do for maintenance stuff on here that you straight up can't do with a scheduler. But if I was just scripting it myself, I absolutely could. Like, that's kind of exciting.
And I'm looking for stuff like that's just built into that will just work on Linux at this point. Like, you know, video transcode acceleration and things like that that you can get to work on BSD, but won't work on TrueNAS. And even if getting to work on BSD seems problematic,
it's a pain.
And frankly, like, the Plex server on BSD is always lagging a couple of versions back. Like, it's not. Yeah, I think this has become a place where the path of least resistance is the thing that more people are using, because which sucks. I feel bad using the thing that is like the thing more people are using just because more people are using it. But sometimes turns out that's what I want, because I don't want to be hassled. It's why I went with the appliance install for Home Assistant, frankly.
Right. That's where the support is. Like, I get it. Like, I really admire the monolithic approach of FreeBSD. You know, it's like, it's one operating system. There aren't a bunch of different distros. Like, it's got one set of very robust documentation. Like, there's like kind of one good way to do everything. Like, I actually, if all other things were equal, I would feel more comfortable using that than Linux. It's just that Linux runs literally everything on the planet, and BSD extremely does not.
You know? Yeah.
So it's like, a lot of the stuff about going with Linux instead is going to kind of be a pain to work around. But like, that time I wanted to run a Terraria server for some friends and then realized, like, oh, the version of Mono that's still packaged for BSD is like years out of date. This is never going to work on Linux. That would be dead simple, you know?
Yeah. Actually, yeah, like just the ability to fire up servers, like have a game server VM that I can run a Linux GSM on and start servers at will easily, it seems really nice.
Just never being bound by, oh, this doesn't run on the OS I'm running is extremely appealing. Here's like another interesting example, that little music server, which is now called Ownone, that I run to do AirPlay devices. Mm-hmm. You have to build that yourself. And on BSD, it takes like, on the 6700K that my NAS is, it takes like 5 to 10 minutes to compile. I did it in a VM on the same machine in Linux, and it took like 30 seconds. And it's because there's like already a bunch of pre-built binaries. This is my guess. I don't know for sure, but I assume it's because there's already a bunch of pre-built binaries that it depends on. And it just like that, it felt very illustrative to me of like, oh, there's already so much more infrastructure in place on the Linux side. Like, that's probably the right choice. It's just going to be a much bigger learning curve.
It's weird because the BSD, the TrueNAS, FreeNAS, in the beginning, that when I started on this path like 10 years ago now, like I went from a home server to a FreeNAS server, like a Windows home server to a FreeNAS server. And in the beginning, it was because I went with TrueNAS because of the plugins and because I could use the GUI and because all of that stuff. And then quickly outgrew the stuff that I could do with that and wanted to have more control and more flexibility. Brad, what do you do about Windows stuff? Do you do Windows spring cleaning at all, or do you just wait until everything gets real bad and then format and reinstall?
I'm like, I've been thinking about that recently. I think my Windows install is coming up on like 3 years old now.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to figure out what Crufty looks like in a modern Windows context, because there's like, I don't really have anything about this machine that I would complain about, like that would make me want to reinstall. Like, I'm like, that feels unheard of by old Windows standards. Like, there's nothing really super broken enough that would make me hose this boot drive at this point.
I did the clean install with Windows 11 when Windows 11 came out, but I was definitely in, I had reached the point where like sometimes opening File Explorer was slow for reasons that weren't related to like hard drive access times or anything like that. It was just slow, which always is a worrisome, like that's not a good, it's not where you want to be. But other than that, yeah, it's weird. Windows doesn't need reinstalling. I do go through and uninstall stuff that I don't use. Like if I have old utilities or something that were attached to a piece of hardware that's no longer attached to the machine, or like something that I've replaced with a different piece. Like if I stopped using Photoshop, I'd uninstall Photo, you know, stuff like that. And then I also do go in and I have an Intel motherboard. So I use that Intel driver update tool, the web-based one. It's very handy and it'll go through and pull all of the stuff that's stuck on your motherboard for you, with hopefully slightly better drivers than the ones that are built into the Windows update driver update process. But that's pretty much it. Like it's, yeah. Oh, and I check offsite backups to make sure that, like if I've added a drive or something like that, to make sure that I haven't forgotten to add it to the offsite backup tool.
The idea of backing up your Windows machine is so foreign to me.
Well, you probably just don't keep anything useful on yours, right?
There's a bunch on the desktop. Like I've got, I do have stuff on the C drive, mostly on the desktop that should probably be backed up, but
You should just use, I used to use, before I started doing the cloud backup stuff, I would use FileBot. Is that it? No. What's the Windows? It's like a power toy for copying entire folders.
Oh,
and I would just clone. It basically works like rsync on Linux. And I would do a copy of.
Oh, it's not RoboCopy, is it?
That's one of them. That's not the one I used. I'm not on my main computer, so I can't look and tell you. But basically, I would take the folders that were important to me and copy them to network share on the NAS, so that they. Because in the old days, my strategy was to back up the NAS and back up everything in the house to the NAS. And then that got kind of expensive in terms of NAS storage because the other computers got big and we got more computers.
Yeah.
But offsite the Backblaze offsite is really incredibly convenient and makes me feel good. And when I've had to restore stuff from there, it's worked really easily. So
yeah.
I've never actually restored a whole machine, but I've definitely pulled lost data before, which is nice. And then the last thing is I audit all the machines on the network.
Yes, your note here in the show notes. Found a few things that I'd forgotten about and disconnected.
Look, there's for a while it tested, we were reviewing all the streaming boxes. And as a result, there are things like, I don't know, Roku sticks plugged into the back of the TV or some streaming box, some weird console, like a Android TV based thing that's just plugged in the back of the TV console where I'll never see it. And yeah, so I went and found all that stuff and unplugged it.
That's probably a good thing to do.
Seems wise.
Like every time I look at the DHCP leases on my router and see a device that I can't identify immediately in my mind.
Yep.
Like it creeps me out. I'm like, ugh, where the fuck did this come from? It's not a pleasant feeling.
The jails. It's always jails for me.
That will happen. Last thing I want to mention real fast, because we were talking about Windows machines. I'm in the grip.
You're going to buy something finally?
The fever. Well, not exactly right now, but the itch is upon me. The upgrade itch is becoming too hard to ignore. There's a bunch of Zen 4 and Raptor Lake news coming out simultaneously, like every day right now.
Yep.
Also, I was chatting with a friend of ours who works at a major CPU vendor.
Weird.
The other day, who was needling me gently about my lack of upgrades for yet another year.
To do that.
Oh, I mean, I get it. But I was also saying, I was like, you know, the 7700K, like, I don't feel like it's really holding me back. And our friend was like, yeah, like, you're not wrong. But also, I bet when you upgrade, you're really going to feel it. And I was like, that was the thing that got to me of like, oh, man, what if there is just unknown, heretofore unknown Windows performance that I could be enjoying that I'm not aware of?
You can't use NVMe drives on that, can you?
No, I boot off one. Like,
off of an empty NVMe?
Yeah.
Oh.
I've had a Samsung Evo in this thing for like 4 years now.
I didn't realize that they went back that far, the 7700 series, but okay. So
it's only PCIe 3, but
that's fine. You're going to see, and you have 16 gigs of RAM.
Yeah.
So going to 32 gigs of RAM, you'll notice an immediate improvement because my laptop is 16 gigs of RAM and it feels incredibly slow after using 64 for a while.
Also, it's going to be 32 gigs of DDR5.
Yeah, that's just going to cost more. It probably won't feel that much different.
In the wake of this conversation, I went and started looking at DDR5 prices and holy shit. And apparently they're good right now compared to where they were.
Like, anytime there's new RAM, it's always expensive.
Last fall, apparently 32 gig of DDR5 at a good speed was like $3,000. And it's at least down to just a few hundred dollars now, but that hurts. And I think, I don't know for a fact, I think both of those new CPUs are maybe going to be DDR5 only.
Well, the AMD side definitely will, I would say. The thing to remember about this memory, my recommendation is on new, like when we did the DDR4 transition, I built a machine right around that time and I actually bought really cheap memory because I knew it was going to be like, as soon as there was supply, you'd be able to get something much better.
Interesting.
For way cheaper.
I've been trying to weigh the cost benefit there because even at the high end, even for like DDR5 6000 right now, the latencies are really bad.
Yeah, so
that's the problem.
I would go value would be my advice.
Huh.
Because the other thing that has happened every, and this has happened literally every time. Now, some of this is probably because I made pre-release hardware, but the DDR3 transition, the DDR4 transition, the first machines I built with those new memory specs, the memory shit the bed within like 3 years every time.
Damn it.
So like, just, you know, you're going to replace that memory and don't spend a ton of money on it.
Mm.
That's my advice.
Okay.
You're going to wait another year now, aren't you?
No, I can't, man. I can't. I'm dying at this point.
It's you've been at time for a long time now.
I'm desperate to upgrade.
Well,
I mean, I could just go get a Zen 3 chip right now, but you know,
I mean, here's the thing. You could get a Zen 3 chip now, use it for a year, and then upgrade your NAS to the Zen, put the Zen 3 in your NAS.
Yeah, but see, then I do what I did last time, which I hate, which is taking a heavy gaming part and putting it in a machine that runs 24/7. Next time I rebuild that NAS, I want it to be with like a low TDP, low power, like
that's fair.
Something like a 65 watt part that actually is like somewhat responsible to leave on all the time.
Yeah. I mean, look, if you switch from BSD to Linux, you'll immediately see power savings because your power management will happen.
Somewhat. I don't know.
Yeah. I
sat there running a power D-V in FreeBSD and like that, it clocks down.
Okay.
And the BSD's gotten a lot better about that stuff.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't do a before and after on the 11.1 to TrueNAS 12.2 update. I should have probably.
Yeah, the 13.0 that I was running, like out of the box, it'll clock down to 800 megahertz when it's idle.
Well, that's nice.
So yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Brad, we've reached the point in time in the show where we thank our patrons.
Thank you, patrons, for listening to that rambly podcast. You're reclining in a bed right now. There's like a big slab of wood behind your head. I feel like this is a slightly more casual podcast than usual.
It's the only quiet room. Like the rest of the house has really high ceilings, so it's super echoey.
Okay.
It's my daughter's room. So both of those are very loud.
Okay. I see. That is maybe the most rugged looking headboard I have ever seen.
I think it's found wood. And then there's a window behind me that I closed so that you didn't get blown out. But yeah, thank you, patrons, so much. As always, Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod is a 100% listener supported podcast. So if you would like to find out how to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/techpod. That's patreon.com/techpod. And for as little as $2 a month, you can join the 3,000 strong community of beautiful nerds in the Tech Pod Discord who talk about stuff like we just did this episode about maintaining computers and making music and playing games and
mechanical keyboards after last week. Holy shit.
Yeah, did you find out about some switches?
Some people have come aggressively at me about the idea of replacing this Apple Magic keyboard, which is still working fine so far post spill.
Did you find out about the Bobas?
Bobas?
Yeah, the Boba switches are the,
is that the hot? Is that the hot switch?
That's the hot quiet switch.
That's the thing. They were telling me that there are pretty quiet switches out there these days. Also, I didn't realize there are keyboards that have hot swappable switches.
Yeah.
So you literally just like pop them
at
off
this point,
right?
Yeah, you have a little grabby thing that you pop them out and you put a new one in.
This, not that I'm like married to any particular brand, but I was looking at the Keychron store because a lot of people on the server like that brand and like they're way cheap. Even the wireless ones with hot swappable switches are cheaper than I expected by a lot.
I would describe Keychron as a wonderful entry point for a mechanical. A lot of people I know start there and end up perfectly happy. And then some people get further down the hole and end up with like weird keys that look like sausages and stuff. So,
yeah. But you could get like a pretty much full size, like a 96% wireless for like $69. Like it's crazy. Like wireless.
Yeah. Well, they do low profile keyboards now too, I believe. So you can get the short throw.
They do. They look cool. I asked around though. And the consensus was you'll be very limited on, you know,
the
selection of switches or keycaps in that space is very limited.
For maximum switch compatibility, you want Cherry MX compatible hot swap, and then you can just pop the switches in and out.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, man. This thing works fine.
I'm not gonna engage in this conversation. This is a trap. I can tell. But what I will do is thank our executive producer tier patrons, including 802.11b Twinkie, Andrew Slosky, Bunny Thorpe Octocrimes, Chris DeBone, Paddle Creek Games, makers of Fractured Veil, David Allen, Jacob Chappell, James Kamick, Joel Krauska, and Wedge. Thank you all, executive producer tier patrons. And it's the end of the month. We'll do a Q&A next week. We decided to do this episode this week and Q&A next week just because this month was short.
Technically, this is the last Sunday of the month, but we decided to obey the spirit of the law rather than the letter.
Yes.
On this one.
So Q&A next week, but we will thank our associate producer dear patrons right now, including Arthur Geese, Dave Yulian, E.W. Kinder, Ram Banks, Jad Rita, Jason Nealand, Jay Maybe, Jorge Pereira, Josh Klein, Julian, Mike Bell, Nathan Phelps, Sanchit Kumar, Steve Lynn, Terry Cox, Thomas Shea, and Travis Rosner. Thank you all so much. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
And I guess that'll do it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. Thanks for listening, everybody.